Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show. This is just one segment of the show. Each weekday, Brian and his guests take on the topics of the day, and you can hear all of these conversations on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
Author Frank McCourt has feet in two worlds.
I was born in New York and taken to Ireland when I was three. I returned to the USA when I was 19. Since then, I've returned to Ireland frequently. Even thought of going back and living there, but that's another story. Yes, going back and forth can be confusing. You wonder who you are, where you belong. Sometimes people ask me, do you consider yourself Irish or American? For a long time, I didn't know how to answer that question. I love both countries, but the people asking the questions were not satisfied. And I wasn't quite satisfied till somehow the answer came, I am a New Yorker. This is where I was born. This is where I came when I was 19. And this is where I've decided I live forever.
Well, that is the best-selling and much-awarded Irishman, American, New Yorker, Frank McCourt, from the beginning of a new WNYC documentary called Feet in Two Worlds, which we will air in full next week. It will premiere on May the 20th. Frank McCourt, of course, the author of the much-awarded Angela's Ashes and Tiz, memoirs of his immigrant and American life. And in conjunction with all the research that our documentary team did for Feet in Two Worlds, we devote this edition of The Brian Lehrer Show to a Feet in Two Worlds community event. We are coming to you from the New School University on West 13th Street in Manhattan, where we will meet seven guests over the course of the next 2 hours, listen to more people's stories, some more excerpts from the documentary Feet in Two Worlds, and hear from members of the audience here at the New School of about 150 people that we have here in the hall. We thank the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School, at the Milano Graduate School here for hosting this event. It should be a great way to raise issues and just to get to know more of your fellow New Yorkers if you're listening to this on the radio. Now, for those of you here in the auditorium, we want to give the people listening on the radio a little chance to get a sense of who's here tonight. So before we actually introduce our guests and play some more clips and let you all talk, let me ask you all a few questions. I'm going to ask you to raise your hands, and I have enlisted one of our guests, WNYC News reporter Cindy Rodriguez, to help translate into audio by telling our radio listeners about how many or what percentage of your hands went up. First of all, how many of you are immigrants yourselves, not born in the United States?
So, Brian, it's hard to tell, but I would say that's over half of the audience.
Okay,
definitely.
So maybe about half of the audience of roughly 150 people or so, children of immigrants?
That's a little bit less.
Yeah, another good quarter at least. Raise your hands if your parents are from Latin America.
I would say about 20 people.
And Europe, if your family's from Europe?
Looks another about 25, the same 30, amount, actually, yeah.
South Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka.
About 15 people.
East Asia, handful.
Looks like, yeah, a handful. Including
all right, so our listeners know that we have pretty darn diverse crowd here. Looks like New York, I might venture to say. And those of you who are immigrants, raise your hand if you feel like you have feet in two worlds. Okay. That's a lot. That's like 30 people, something like that.
Definitely.
All right. So later on, we're going to ask you to get descriptive about that. We'll ask the essay question and ask you to maybe stand up and talk a little bit about what that means. Raise your hand if, like Frank McCourt in that clip we heard, you have settled on New Yorker as your main identity. Hey, most of those people, huh?
Yeah, it is.
That is cool. Raise your hand if you're an immigrant and actually live part-time or spend part of most years in your country of origin?
I only see
two or three.
Raised.
Okay. How many of you have children back in the old country? Anybody? One.
One person.
We're going to hear about another, and he's one of our guests later. So maybe we'll hear his story, and we'll hear a clip from the documentary about people who do, and painfully so. How many of you can even imagine leaving your young children, a set of twins, behind as you emigrate to another country? Almost nobody. One person can imagine it, at least. We will hear that.
Another person back here.
Two.
Right.
How many of you have ever sent money to your families back home?
Plenty of hands going up.
And we'll talk more about that. And how many of you seriously consider going back to live?
I'd say about 10, 15 people.
Yeah, more than you might have guessed, some of you listening right now. Okay, so now you have a sense, a little sense of some of the people who are here and some of the conditions of their immigrant lives. And with that, I want to introduce our panelists. Rob Smith, associate professor at Baruch College's School of Public Affairs. He's the author of a book that's not yet published, but which I've had the honor and pleasure and brain-stimulating experience of reading part of, Mexican New York, Transnational Worlds of New Immigrants, to be published by the University of California Press. Chung Hua Hong, Associate Director of the New York Immigration Coalition. Gary Pierre-Pierre, Editor of the Haitian Times newspaper. And Cindy Rodriguez, WNYC radio reporter and a reporter for the Feet in Two Worlds documentary. Please welcome our panelists. And Rob Smith, Professor Smith, I'm going to start with you and some of the ideas raised in your forthcoming book. And I want to start with this basic idea of transnational community. We'll probably be using that term a lot and that word, transnational, in the next couple of hours. What do you mean by transnational?
There's a number of ways to look at it, but the basic idea is this. The old theories about immigration would look at people leaving one country, going to another country, and then there was theories about how people became assimilated, and in that era it meant how they became American, which meant over a couple of generations they would lose their links to the old country. But scholars began to notice that, in fact, increasing numbers of people were not leaving their links to the old country, and in fact these links were growing, and not only were migrants not leaving them, but the home states, Mexico, Ecuador, Brazil, other places, began to also attempt to cultivate these links. And then scholars further began to look back in history and realize, hey, this is not brand new. The Italian state did the same thing. The Portuguese state did the same thing. So that the term that I actually prefer to community is transnational life, and it refers to the extent to which migrants create a sort of what some scholars call a transnational social field in which they live simultaneously in two places. Now, it doesn't require that everyone be a jet setter and spend 6 months in one place and 6 months in the other, but it speaks to a social reality where people, and I think Frank McCourt, as he always does, captured it quite beautifully, saying, you know, people are, they're neither in one place nor in the other in their heads, and that they have concrete links to both places.
And Rob, your book is largely about immigrants from one region of Mexico that you actually use a fake name for. You can tell us why you didn't want to identify the real place. But that accounts for 70% of the Mexican immigrants to New York. Why didn't you identify it? And I think it will surprise a lot of our listeners to find out that one relatively small area of Mexico accounts for 70% of the Mexicans here.
Freelance journalists is the answer to why I didn't identify it.
Vultures who were come in and steal
actually,
your research.
That joke played really well in Las Vegas last week. I don't know why it didn't work here.
Freelance journalists.
Thank you, Brian. It's for confidentiality, I had a long-term relationship. This is 17 years I've been involved with this research community. People have told me very intimate things, and I wanted to be able to write about them, but also to be able to protect people's identities and their stories. The larger region from which this little town that I call Tijuana where that is situated is the Mixteca region, and between the states of Puebla, Oaxaca, and Guerrero, the region overlaps those three states. It accounts for about 70% of Mexican migration to New York, which is now someplace around, in New York City alone, my estimate is about 400 and 450,000 Mexicans in the city. So
well, that's a lot, and that's a lot more than the Census Bureau officially tells us, which is already a lot. They say now that Mexico provides the fifth most, or is the fifth largest source of immigrant population in New York, with officially about 120,000. So you think there are that many more. But why would there be a connection between that region of Mexico and New York in particular? Why not L.A.? Why not Phoenix? Why do they come so much further to concentrate here?
Well, partly it's a historical accident that the town that I've studied in is actually a place from which the first migrants from the region came, and they actually came in the 1940s. And they tried to bribe their way into a labor contract, but couldn't do that, and then met somebody that lived in New York who vacationed in Mexico City and brought them here. And so basically you've then had slowly growing chain migration, and then due to a variety of factors in the 1980s, an explosion in that migration. That's the short version of the history.
Like most migrant concentrations, once for some reason there's a foothold of a population, then people just come because there are people they know, people like them.
Yeah, that's right.
And you have a stat that 40% of people from this fictitious Tijuana return there to live, 40%, and more than half are involved in what you call transnational life. Do you mean 40% eventually go back there permanently?
No, not return to live necessarily, but are involved in some substantive way in transnational life, meaning they will go back to visit every 2-3 years. They may only stay for a few weeks. They may be participating. They may not go back, but they may, for the last 30 years, have been giving money for public works projects. So that there's some substantive involvement. That it's not just that they have this identity and they don't do anything about it, but there's a substantive part of their life which is oriented towards this. It's a primary identity they have. There may be, I mean, there's a church in Brooklyn which just had a replica of the icon of the patron saint of the town installed. And so that the people can do their religious rituals here as well as there. I mean, it's a concrete manifestation of their identity as people from this town. It's a transnational identity as well, because it's, you know, people say it doesn't matter if you're born here, you're born there, where you are, you're still a Tijuanense.
Gary Pierre, editor of the Haitian Times, you think that's roughly true with the Haitian community in New York, too?
Most certainly. But in the case of the Haitian community, there's a bit of a tragedy now with the turmoil in Haiti, where a lot of people would love to go back, but they shy away from it. And so right now you have a lot of people very nostalgic.
And Cheng Le Hung from the New York Immigration Commission, do you think this is generally true with immigrants in New York, that so many kind of live transnational lives, spend part of the year back where they came from?
Yes, I think that's definitely true. And I think it's a reflection of the increasing globalization that we see with, you know, movement of capital, of people, of businesses, and so on. And that, but I do want to say that it is different in every country. Some countries, some of the push factors are more economic. Other countries is more political, and so that really shapes the immigrant population here. You know, the immigrants from Cuba are going to be very different in political outlook from immigrants from, you know, El Salvador, for instance. So there's a lot of not just racial and nationality diversity, but also of their experiences and the political outlook, and, you know, what they come here looking for.
So obviously, if they're escaping political oppression, for example, they're not going to spend a lot of time going back and forth.
Exactly.
We'll pick it up there when we continue. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our Feet in Two Worlds immigration special from the New School. This is the WNYC Feet in Two Worlds community event at the New School with the Center for New York City Affairs. I'm Brian Lehrer. Again, a reminder that the Feet in Two Worlds documentary will air four times on WNYC beginning May 20th. You can check our website, wnyc.org, or just listen to the station for more specific details about when you can hear it. And here's another excerpt from the Feet in Two Worlds documentary. This is WNYC Cindy Rodriguez reporting on a couple from Ecuador, Roberto and Dolores, who live in Jackson Heights and have two sons here, but had to leave their young twins behind. The poignant irony of leaving your own children in order to build a better life for them in the long run. And in this scene, they talk to them and see them via video phone at a local call center.
Roberto and Dolores and their two sons look like a wholesome and whole family, but they're not complete. The couple has two more children, twins being raised by Dolores' mother in Ecuador. The family has been separated for 14 years. In the basement of a money transfer office, Roberto and Dolores will spend an hour in a video conference trying to erase the distance between the two parts of their family. The twins turn 16 today, and for $1.50 a minute, the couple and their two sons living with them in Queens will sit in a room with four black leather armchairs and one 30-inch flat-screen TV monitor hanging from the wall. When they enter the room, the image of their family in Ecuador is already on the television screen. 10 of them are seated in two neat rows in what looks like the waiting room of a bleak doctor's office.
Vamos a comenzar, Cecilita. Son las 2:38.
The couple cries as they watch their children, nieces, nephews, Dolores' sister, aunt, and mother also weep thousands of miles away. It's as if the family is seeing each other for the first time.
That from the documentary, Feet in Two Worlds. Cindy Rodriguez, tell us more about this family. I also have two sons, and it's hard to imagine the conditions that would make me leave them behind. As we heard from the audience before, it's hard for most people to imagine leaving your children behind to move to another country. Why did Roberto and Dolores do it?
Well, they told me that they did it because they thought it was for their benefit, so that they could support them and they could provide for them better lives. And they also have four children. One of them is four and was born here. Another one is also a teenager that did manage to come to the U.S. and is with them now. And the two twins stayed there. Roberto really hardly knows the twins. Well, he does know them. I mean, he speaks to them very regularly on the phone. But he hasn't really seen them. You know, he hasn't really had any physical contact with them since they were about 4 years old. Dolores has, but she still has been away from them for about 10 years. And
10 years?
Yeah. So it was an interesting place. It's a place, it's actually a money transfer place for Ecuadorians specifically. And in the basement, there's a room where you can contact your family through video conferencing. And it's a pretty emotional thing for everybody that's there. They, the second that you ask them, you know, what they're doing and, you know, who they're going to speak to, they almost immediately start to cry.
So, are they here legally?
No, they're not.
And is that why they can't bring their children?
The
other children?
Right. That's
Chung-Wa Hong from the New York Immigration Coalition. Do you think this is a story that's more common than we may think?
Yeah, I wanted to just note that family separation is actually a recurring theme in immigrant communities, and it happens for various reasons. Sometimes it happens when people initially immigrate, like the family we're talking about. Other times, a whole family is already here, and members of that family, sometimes the breadwinner, gets deported for minor immigration violations or just for instance, special registration was something that was required of male South Asian Muslim and Middle Eastern men, and if you don't register, you're deportable. Other times, you're here already and you petition for your family members, and because of the backlogs and the lack of visas available, it takes years and years and years to invite your family members. I know people who are in the States in different cities. I have a friend who couldn't go fly to a wedding of her sister because she was undocumented, could not get on the plane because that would be risking deportation because she didn't have an ID. So the issue, I think, is an issue of an immigration system that does not allow for the transnational or the circularity or movement of people that has already become a reality, and superimposed on that some of the economic poverty issues, you know, which also make it very difficult. So I think it's a tragic situation, but I think there's a solution to addressing it.
And that is?
I didn't want to talk
if
too
you want to follow. If you want a follow-up question, end an answer like that.
I think there is. We're in discussions in Washington, D.C. about immigration reform that really addresses some of the outdated aspects of our immigration system, because we have a big national problem and a challenge on our hands, which is the existence of over 10 million people who are undocumented, who are outside of our legal system. And so instead of trying to deny that reality, you know, let's deal with it. What kind of lives are they living? What are their contributions? What is the reality? How do we make them part of our society so that it benefits both those immigrants and those of us who are living with them every day?
And we'll talk more as we go along here about some of the immigration policy news that's in the headlines today and some that may be coming along in a few days or a few weeks down the pike. I want to invite members of our audience to raise your hands if you want to participate in the conversation, maybe add your own stories about transnational life or ask any questions of the panelists. So just raise your hands when you're ready, and we'll bring somebody around with a microphone. Gary Pierre-Pierre from the Haitian Times, how durable do you think transnational life is? And, of course, there have been times in Haiti's history where things have been a little mellower, people have been able to go back and forth a little more easily. Is it merely transitional? Is it bound to give way to assimilation and Americanization over time?
Well, I think the answer is very simple. When I look at my own situation, where I have a 7-year-old daughter whose mother is American and very much American, and she fancies herself so much a Haitian, and I can't imagine one day her not wanting to continue and seeking more knowledge about where her father's homeland, or birthland actually, is. Like, you know, we've talked about it, there's no other way around it with technology and transportation being so fast now. And so before, back in the last century, during the last century, it was quite difficult to go back to Ireland, even if you wanted to. So you just made that, you know, mental break with it. Now it's very simple, very easy. And you, from the report of with your correspondent, you can just go in the basement. They can look at your family, even if you can't actually touch them. But before, that was impossible. So I would imagine with technology, that trend will definitely continue.
Let's take our first comment from the audience.
Hi.
Sir, over there. Hi.
Hi. Thanks. This is to Professor Smith. I was wondering, my name is Richard Kagan. I'm a writer, actually, with Education Update. What kind of educational opportunities are happening for these young immigrants? I mean, are they doing well in high school? Are they going to college? You know, I mean, this is supposedly the land of opportunity, and this has to be an important issue.
By the way, you're not one of those freelance journalists, are you?
Yeah, I'm almost free. Yeah.
Well, it's, I mean, there's two answers to the question, at least. And, I mean, one of them is most immigrants are going into urban areas in the United States. You know, the country has had a program of you know, underfunding and neglecting urban school districts for the last, you know, as long as I can remember, you know, just as a general policy, spending has not been going up. So in the sense, then, they're all in the same boat as everybody else, that, which is it's not a sinking boat, but it's a boat that's taking on water. But the other question, particularly about undocumented immigrants, this comes back to the point that Chung Hua made before. There have been very varied approaches. Depending on what state you're in, if you're undocumented, your chances to go to college and to then move on and get a better job, et cetera, are very different. And there's been a big movement on this. What's been happening is that you've had at the local level, in a variety of places, local authorities and state authorities have come to acknowledge the human reality that you have, you know, millions of people who are undocumented. I know kids who've been born in other countries and come here when they're a few months old, and then they graduate from high school and they find out that they're undocumented. Or their counselor tells them that they can't go, their guidance counselor tells them they can't go to high school, or go to college, which is actually not true in New York State. In New York State, you can go, if you're undocumented, at in-state tuition rates. It's a state law that Governor Pataki, under certain conditions, that Governor Pataki signed a couple of years ago. But if you're in other states that have tougher sort of anti-immigrant measures, you have to pay out of state or you're barred entirely. Now, the point that comes back to what Chung-Wa was saying before is you've had a variety of states that have acknowledged this human reality and attempted on the local level or the state level to make policies that include these members of our society in a legal way and to give them a chance to participate more fully. What you're now seeing over the last several years is really a rather mean-spirited policy at the federal level to incapacitate local and state communities to be able to accommodate and include those members of the society. It's a quite interesting, sort of curious result, too, for people who are doing this want smaller government, and yet they're putting the federal government into more and more aspects of our lives.
Now, of course, on a policy level, many Americans would say that it's worth it to them to have the federal government police their communities for illegal immigrants because illegal immigrants cost them in various ways. I don't want this to bog too much down into a policy discussion, and we'll have some of it later. But does that affect their ability to get educated since the schools don't check? Going back to the comment in the audience member's question?
Well, in K through 12, the Supreme Court has ruled that undocumented immigrants have a right to attend college, Plyler v. Doe decision. After, higher education, it's state by state. In some states, you're completely barred. In others, New York is a pretty good state to be, it's not good to lack papers, but if I was going to, this would be a place that I would come. New York is a pretty good place compared to
go to college without getting busted.
Yeah. I mean, you then get the problem is, right, you get these students who have, you know, they're sort of carriers of the American dream, right? They don't get any loans. They pay their way through. They do well. Then they get out, and can they get a job, right? I mean, we've talked a little before about the DREAM Act. It would make a tremendous amount of sense. I mean, how can you hold somebody responsible when they've come here when they're 3 months old for the fact that they still don't have papers? It makes no sense on any level.
This is our Feet in Two Worlds special at the New School. I'm Brian Lehrer. Our panelists for this part of the program, Rob Smith, who was just speaking, associate professor at Baruch College School of Public Affairs, author of the forthcoming Mexican New York, Transnational Worlds of New Immigrants. Also, Gary Pierre-Pierre, editor of the Haitian Times newspaper. Cindy Rodriguez, WNYC news reporter and a contributor to the Feet in Two Worlds documentary. And Chung-Hwa Hong, associate director of the New York Immigration Coalition. Rob Smith, I want to stay with you for a minute, and I want you to respond to kind of the inevitability of assimilation that I think Gary was articulating a minute ago, because I also noticed in your book that you analyze what you call the transnationalization of adolescence in the second generation in this particular Mexican region case, and you say there's a strong embrace of local culture and rituals. And I wonder if that's unusual, because the classic narrative is one of Americanization of the second generation.
I mean, I think part of the reason why this seems so curious is that many people think that transnational life is incommensurate with assimilation, that if you live in a transnational life, you can't assimilate, that they're a zero-sum game, and that's not the case. In fact, some of the people who are most successfully, quote-unquote, assimilated, right, that they've been able to go to college, that they have good jobs, they've had the chance to get citizenship and they've gotten it, are then the most transnational because they're actually able to travel, they have a little bit more disposable income. And so I think recasting the terms of the debate so that it has to do with living simultaneously in both places, and it doesn't mean that you need to surrender one identity or set of practices for the other.
And Gary, in better times in Haiti, you think that's true of the Haitian community as well?
Well, most certainly. I mean, I remember when I was 12 years old, my mom was filling out her citizenship papers, and she asked me to include me with her And I told her, no, I didn't want to become an American because after college I want to go back to Haiti and work at home. And 20-something years later, I'm still here, and I have no plans of going back. But I'm
did you become a citizen?
Yes, indeed, because I wanted to join the Peace Corps, and I had to be a citizen to do so.
Huh. But I think Rob's point is that if you became a citizen, it wouldn't stop you from going back.
Well,
and
I didn't
know
that.
If you went back, it wouldn't stop you from sort of being an American.
Certainly. I mean, this is part of the transformation, the maturity that you go through. But at some point, you do believe that. You do feel – I mean, there are a lot of Haitians today who feel that way. They say they'll never become a citizen because it's just giving up their identity. The whole idea of changing a passport is almost sacrilegious.
Cindy, did you see this in the Ecuadorian community that you covered as well?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I saw I guess the families that I dealt with in the two pieces that I did, these kids were coming over in the second piece that I did. The children that were coming over were just coming over, and that assimilation process hadn't happened, but the two kids were definitely going to start school. In the video conferencing piece, the two children that were born here, one was definitely, the four-year-old was definitely already speaking English. He wanted to speak English, but actually during the video conferencing, his grandmother was asking him, say something for me in English, and he wouldn't because he was embarrassed.
Mm. And so, Chenghua Hung, do you think there are implications for the nature of American life as time goes on, as more and more immigrants from more and more places live in a transnational way? Are there implications for community cohesion in the United States compared to the way it was before it was so easy to travel and communicate with today's technology?
Yeah, and like Rob said, I think it's not a mutually exclusive thing. And I myself immigrated when I was 11 years old, and a lot of people in the Korean community call that 1.5 generation. You're not completely Korean, and you're not completely American. You're kind of 1.5, and sometimes people say, well, I'm 1.7 or 1.2. You know, there's gradations of, you know, how you want to define yourself on a line. But
and how many feet do you have your world?
That's right. And then, but what I think is really positive these days is that young people these days don't feel like they have to choose one over the other. So you would have young people being really feeling proud that they know the rock bands in their home country and that they know the moves of these, you know, hip-hop groups or whatever, and at the same time, you know, the cultural stuff here. So I think young people kind of get it because they're growing up in a, you know, hopefully a more tolerant place in New York. But I think a lot of the old-fashioned people are still thinking in terms of this or that. A lot of the native-born communities, you know, are, I think their primary objection to immigrants is still articulated as, well, they don't want to assimilate. They don't want to speak English. But then if you really look at the immigrants, that's just not true. Immigrants want to learn English. Immigrants want to be integrated and participate on an equal footing in all the civic and cultural and social life, but there are barriers. And so that's where we could do a better job.
We'll continue in a minute with our Feed Into World special from the New School, Brian Lehrer, on WNYC. This is the WNYC Feed Into Worlds community event at the New School with the Center for New York City Affairs. The Feed Into Worlds documentary will air four times on WNYC beginning on May 20th. Check our website at WNYC.org for specific air times, or just keep listening to the station and we'll tell you specifically as they get closer. For those of you who listening who don't happen to work for the Census Bureau, here are some interesting data about immigrant New York and the immigrant United States today. There are about 2.8 million foreign-born people in New York City, counted by the 2000 census and immigration data. This may vastly understate certain groups, especially Mexicans, according to them, and advocates. But ranked, in case you're curious and don't know, the number one immigrant group in New York City these days, the Dominicans from the Dominican Republic, with officially about 370,000 people, then Chinese, 260,000, Jamaicans, 180,000, people from Guyana, 130,000, then Mexico, 120, though we heard Rob estimate before that it's hundreds of thousands more than that. Then the sixth largest immigrant population in the city today, people from Ecuador, 114,000. Then people from Haiti, 95,000. Trinidad and Tobago, 88,000. Colombia, 84,000. And Russia, 81,000. So that's where some of the New Yorkers come from, who now make up, between immigrants and children of immigrants, a majority of New York City's population. And more than 43% of these immigrants arrived after 1990. Also, nearly half of the city's population speaks a language other than English at home, which doesn't mean they don't also speak English at home, as I think we just heard. Well over half, at least 56% of the city's population is made up of immigrants and children of immigrants, according to official stats now. And that's New York. And if you think we're so unique, well, in many ways we are, but nationwide, more than one-fifth of all U.S. children under age six are the children of immigrants, and nearly all those children are citizens. Thus, the rest of the nation will increasingly become a nation of immigrants, as New York City is one. Half of those parents arrived in the U.S. within the last 10 years, and by 2020, estimates are, about one-third of U.S. children will have at least one foreign-born parent. So, little statistical grounding in who we are and who we're becoming as a city and a nation. As we continue with our Feet Into World special from the New School with Rob Smith, from Baruch College's School of Public Affairs, author of the forthcoming Mexican New York, Transnational Worlds of New Immigrants, Chung Hua Hong, Deputy Director of the New York Immigration Coalition, an advocacy group for immigrants, Gary Pierre Pierre, editor of the Haitian Times newspaper, publishing in New York for the Haitian community here, and Cindy Rodriguez, WNYC news reporter and a contributor to the Feed Into Worlds documentary. Let's go back to some of the members of our audience and hear what else they have to say or to ask. Hello.
Hi, my name is Bibian Agard, and I'm an African immigrant. As a matter of fact, you skipped Africa. I don't know the role Africa plays in this, because we have a lot of African immigrants. In the chat, there's no mention about how many African immigrants you have in New York, but I know we have a lot. And you didn't take the poll, too. Secondly, you will never know what it is to be an immigrant unless you're a first-generation immigrant. I came to America 2003, and I'm documented. But I won't tell you, it wasn't an easy ride. I had a master's degree before coming, but I had to work as a security guard for a year. Walking, keeping weight at night, when people are sleeping, I'll be awake, praying that I'll be safe. And then you found out that before even you left your country, you had great expectations. You thought things are going to be so rosy, your friends are taking your phone addresses and all that. And only for you to come here, you found out that you ask yourself, what am I doing? You begin to question whether you took the right, make the right decision by coming over. Things are so hard, your experiences over the years are not counted. Even your education is, you find them putting a question mark to it. And then you couldn't go back because they will see you as a failure. Why did you come back when you could have made it? Why didn't you fight to make it? So it's not really easy. And then you still have to struggle within the conflict of culture. Because where you're coming from, there are things you held in high esteem, things you held so dear you believe you can never, is a taboo. Then when you come here, it becomes an order of the day. Like the first time I saw a lady who took her mother to court for not being able to pay her fridge, the money to pay for the fridge she gave to her mother. It was, to me, a taboo because I know we took care of our families. And then each time you hear about problems in your country, your first question is, how about my family? You try to reach them, and at times this phone can't get through. And even the undocumented ones, I know a lady who's been here for 22 years. She can't go home. She doesn't even know what her mother looks like, except when they send tapes and all that. So it's been quite difficult. In as much as we're looking at the undocumented immigrants, we should try as much as possible also to make life easy for the documented ones.
Can I ask what country in Africa you came here from?
I'm from Nigeria.
And having a master's degree there and anticipating probably working as something like a security guard here, why was it worth it to you to take this risk?
Yeah, actually, back home, they talk so much about America. When you grew up, I grew up having this dream that you've got to be in America or Canada to be it. You believe if you've not been there, you have not really actualized. And then having come, you know, of course, spent so much to be here, closed my practice. I was in legal practice. I closed my practice to be here. And then how could I just go back? Whose client will I take over? What story do I tell them? You know, you have to come back. You have to make it the world as I'm making it. But I thank God I've left the security job. But then it was not easy. Keeping awake at night, it wasn't easy.
Who on the panel wants to respond?
Well, I think this is a classic story that we all go through, all immigrants. I mean, life in America is not easy. I came here when I was 10 years old, and it still wasn't easy. I spent the first 3 months at school not learning, not knowing English, and at that time they didn't have ESL, so I just slept for 2 months. And I had to adjust.
I slept for 6 months. That's good. Did you wake up for lunch?
Yes. I didn't like the food at all.
Really?
Thank you for speaking up. Can we go to our next speaker? And it's this woman right here. Hi.
Hi, my name is Sarah Prosh. I work with Association Tepayac. It's an immigration advocacy organization working with Latino immigrants, primarily Mexican, primarily undocumented immigrants. I spend my days teaching about education and labor rights, and I feel like, you know, I could easily spend just as much time educating, you know, United States-born citizens about what rights immigrants have. For instance, you know, workers, regardless of their documented status, you know, have access to workers' compensation. Need to be paid minimum wage and time and a half, for instance. And I'm wondering how we can kind of bridge this gap, how we can kind of relate to issues that would bring people into the discussion about rights that might not necessarily think that they would have anything to do with it. And I'm thinking if anybody could speak to maybe the Real ID Act that was passed in Congress last week, which, you know, a lot of people are obviously opposing across the political spectrum.
Well, Chung-Wa Hung, I guess you're her fellow activist, so maybe you want to talk about...
I feel like I'm back at work. So Real ID Act, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a very anti-immigrant piece of legislation, which is passing in the Senate right as we speak, I believe. It makes it impossible for undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses. It makes it very difficult for asylum seekers to get asylum, so many of them will be returned to the home countries where they'll be persecuted or tortured. It curtails legal rights for immigrants and so on. And it's very unfortunate, but those sets of things were passed because anti-immigrant legislators made it into a security issue. When we think it's security was just an excuse to really cram through kind of a standing anti-immigrant agenda that some of the more radical right-wing elements in our Congress wanted to pass. So it's very unfortunate that something like that is passing, and that's going to make lives of hundreds of thousands of immigrants in New York very difficult. Immigrant families aren't going to be able to drive to work or take their kids to the hospital. It's going to be a crime to drive to work. I know someone who was deported because he was a delivery man driving a truck, but he got caught driving without a license. So it's having a heavy toll. And so that's what I mean by saying that unless our nation really deals with the fundamental problem of how do we deal with all these immigrants who are already here and part of our community, do we just deny them, you know, rights to this and rights to that, driver's licenses, to education and whatever? Or do we say, you know, what do we do about this problem, this challenge? Because the whole transnationalism is something that's already a reality, and the circularity and the way that people travel follows where they're needed economically and so on. So I think it's one of the toughest questions to answer. It's a tough policy question, but the place we have to start has to be what kind of policies are realistic and what kind of policies will both help the immigrants who are part of our country already and also help those help the rest of the country as well.
And Chung-Wa, let me jump in and do my job as moderator and challenge you on at least part of that.
Sure.
The part in which you said this just comes from anti-immigrant legislators in Congress, they certainly cite the 9/11 Commission, and I don't know if you consider them anti-immigrant also, but the 9/11 Commission, which concluded that something needs to be done in terms of identity cards because, for example, a number of the 9/11 hijackers did have legitimate driver's licenses that they were able to obtain even though they were not in the country, in some of those cases, legally.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up because, in fact, our whole recommendation was heed the advice or the recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. When the 9/11 Commission passed their intelligence bill at the end of last year, they had a provision that set some national standard for driver's licenses. Representative Sensenbrenner and others just ignored that and went way beyond what was needed for security reasons. You do not need to be checking, tying immigration status to your ability to drive. That is not the problem. We support, you know, tamper-resistant documents that are secure, but denying millions of people the ability to drive just because you're undocumented or somehow, you're being undocumented makes you more likely to be terrorist is a premise that we have to challenge and is going in a direction that makes us less safe because you're looking at entire groups of people as more suspect instead of going after, people with actual suspicious individualized behavior. And you can get on a plane with the passport or a bunch of other documents. A driver's license was not the problem.
This is our Feed in Two Worlds community event from the New School. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And let's go to another member of the audience, this gentleman over here on my left.
Hi, my name is Eric. So changing the topic a tad, I was remembering my own experience growing up, actually. I'm the son of Cuban immigrants to New York, another sort of small community as well. But I didn't speak English, actually, until the age of about, six, when I was, in first grade. Going into school, I had only spoken Spanish. And at the time, when my brother was younger, he's 10 years older than I am, in the 70s, he went straight into English education, and he learned English sort of forcefully. He had to learn English. I mean, everybody surrounds. But I went into bilingual education. And in that, I struggled a lot because the teacher would begin a phrase in Spanish and then just stick in a random English phrase. And I used to be like, ¿qué? And he used to be completely lost. And I would cry. I remember crying at home. So difficult to learn English for me. And going into second grade, I didn't read English until about the second grade. So I hear a lot about that today, even today. Latinos particularly seem to be the focus of bilingual education legislation and so forth, but I'm trying to hear about other immigrant communities, Russians that, for example, don't have even the Roman alphabet, Chinese immigrants, Arabic immigrants, they don't seem to struggle as much with English or have legislation dealt directly to them as Latinos do. What do the panelists think about that?
Who wants it? Chung Hua, reluctantly.
Yes. First of all, I think bilingual programs are just like other programs, whether it's special education or math, that if you are enrolled in a good quality bilingual program, I've seen examples of people learning English more effectively in bilingual programs. Other times it's ESL classes and so on. I think it's deplorable that our public school system does not provide enough English classes, whether bilingual or just straight English, that you only an immigrant kid coming into the New York public school system only gets a couple of hours of English a day or less than a couple of hours. So that's why we're fighting for more English instruction after school and on the weekends. So I think that's one thing. And as someone who came, and slept most of the school days, I think, when I was in fifth grade, sixth grade, and so on, I think it is important for the schools to provide the kind of education to the children so that they can learn English step by step and provide language access to parents so that the parents get involved.
Can I jump in and ask the gentleman who asked the question, based on your experience, and you obviously had a very specific and relatively unsatisfying experience, although obviously you can speak English extremely well today. Do you have any recommendations? Do you think bilingual education is a political agenda that doesn't serve an educational agenda, or any other conclusion?
Well, I've seen bilingual education today, at least in my just close-knit group of friends, which happen to be mostly Dominican, in Washington Heights, in the Washington Heights section of Manhattan, where bilingual education, I think, works sort of at the younger level. But when you're going into a high school, and I see my friends' cousins coming back with textbooks in sociology and anthropology and economics, all in Spanish, for example, I'm just thinking that's a little detrimental to them at that age to be having full textbooks in Spanish. So I think English needs to be a little more sort of, I don't mean to say forcefully for lack of better words, but there needs to be more English said into the classroom at the high school level. But at the younger level, I think it's traumatic to teach a child just English. There needs to be more of a balance, like you were alluding to there.
Rob Smith?
You know, there's actually another model that we should talk about here, which is the dual immersion model. My son is in a New York City public school, and he spends half the week in Spanish and half the week in English, and the kid's basically fluent, and he's in second grade. A model like this, I mean, look, you know the old joke, if you speak three languages, you're trilingual, two, you're bilingual, and one language, you're an American. Right? It's the joke when you go to Europe. I mean, it would serve all of our interests if we were to expand funding for things like that. And I want to underline Chung Hwa's point. Bilingual education badly done doesn't work. Neither does monolingual education badly done and underfunded. Right? I mean, I think that's an issue that we need to keep on the table.
One Gary, point we have to take a break in 20 seconds, but go ahead and add something.
20 seconds. I just think...
Come on, it's radio. Do a soundbite.
Imagine how difficult it is to teach someone in America Creole. I mean, Spanish is an international language, and this is happening in the New York City public school system.
All right, and we will continue with our Feed Into Worlds community event from the New School, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Welcome back for the second hour of our Feet in Two Worlds community event. I'm Brian Lehrer from the New School on West 13th Street in Manhattan. With our audience of about 125, 150 people, a cool mix of immigrants and the native-born, as you know if you were listening before, just like New York. And again, we thank the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School University for hosting this event. Later in the hour, arts and culture in the hybrid city. But first, we'll pick up where we left off before the news on transnational life and politics. And let's play another clip from the Feet in Two Worlds documentary, which will be airing on the station beginning next week. This scene takes place in a Polish pharmacy in Greenpoint, and is reported by Eva Kern-Jędrzejowska, who writes for a Polish New York newspaper.
Miss Eva Tunia, the pharmacist, got her degree back in Poland. She came to the United States 16 years ago when she was in her 20s and has been working here ever since. She doesn't really fit into my stereotype of a pharmacist. She's attractive and well-dressed. Her makeup looks good, and she's always tanned and smiling.
To znaczy pani już dostała w płynie ten antybiotyk.
Since Miss Eva is busy on the phone right now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about this place. You almost never hear English, only Polish. It's kind of cozy. The lights are low, there's music playing, and there's always lots of people standing around, talking, hanging out, transferring money, getting documents translated, sending letters to Poland, and even checking their blood pressure.
Hello, let me measure your blood pressure, pulse rate, and weight.
It's a friendly place. People come to speak about their problems, their issues, and sometimes it's more of a social speak-out circle than it's a practical medical advice giving.
That's Piotr. He's a photographer who lives around here.
I pick up my batteries, I get my shampoo, Tylenol, and chats with a couple of friends that I've met there over time that work there, who can give me anywhere from fulfilling my prescription to an advice with what to do with my dry hair.
Bardzo dużo osób ma tutaj stany nerwicowe, ponieważ są z daleka od rodziny.
Miss Eva says the most common problem she sees are what she calls the neurotic type. It's people who are far from their families who seem to come here the most.
Był taki młody chłopak właśnie, który posiadał.
She remembers one young guy who had a condition where he needed to have a bottle of water with him at all times. Otherwise, he felt he would suffocate.
That scene from the Feet in Two Worlds documentary, a revealing glimpse of life in a corner of immigrant New York for people who don't know it, which is certainly most of you. And I guess we learned that even a medicine from your childhood can be a form of comfort food. We continue with our panelists, Rob Smith, associate professor at Baruch College School of Public Affairs and author of Mexican New York, Transnational Worlds of New Immigrants, to be published later this year by the University of California Press. Chung-Hwa Hong, deputy director of the New York Immigration Coalition. Gary Pierre-Pierre, editor of the Haitian Times newspaper. And Cindy Rodriguez, a reporter for WNYC News and a contributor to the Feet in Two Worlds documentary. Rob Smith, I guess that clip from Greenpoint shows us again some evidence of the economic nature of immigration. And we talked last hour about how people could even leave some of their children behind in order to take the risk to make the journey to this country. We heard the woman in the audience from Nigeria speak. And yet it's almost surprising that in this day of globalization of the economy that we still hear people feel they have to come to America in such numbers in order to have this economic dream, this traditional American dream, become a reality for the families.
Well, it shouldn't be that surprising. I mean, we live in a globalized world, which means basically that, if we look at the institutions that we're sitting within, labor does not move freely, and capital and money and investment does move freely. We have markets that are open for investment but not for people. So we've got all of the institutions set up so that people with money can accumulate more of it, but there's not really as much of an investment in, for example, keeping families together.
Let's go right back to another member of the audience, and our next speaker is right here.
My name is Jayanti Ramaswamy. I'm coming from New Jersey. I immigrated here 20 years ago, and at that time, I remember people would be curious about me. They'd look at my sari, they'd look at me and ask, "Are you Hindi? Do you speak Hindu? Do you do yoga? Are you vegetarian?" And today, they know so much about me. I'm surprised. I don't know about myself. They watch because of the software industry in India, 2020 has programs about India, and they inform me about bright burning. They know more about India than I do now. But this is just a comment I wanted to make. I used to work as a software engineer. I've taken a hiatus because I had a daughter, and now I'm trying to get back to work. I want to get certified as a teacher. But my master's degree from India is not recognized, so I'm going through a hard certification process. And it's just a comment I wanted to make that as long as we believe in capitalism and, in the global economy, today it's India that's taking the software jobs away from here. It could be Brazil tomorrow taking it away from India and so on, and we just have to accept it, I guess.
The way things are changing, do any of the Indians or Indian Americans that you know think of going back for opportunity, or is transnational culture taking hold in that way at all?
I have heard of many Indians going back. In fact, a long time ago when I migrated here, and this was where everyone wanted to be, especially people like my husband who has a PhD in biophysics. There was a chemist from his company who went back to India. And he didn't come back. Everyone predicted he would come back. But he didn't come back, and he's happy there.
Thank you very much for speaking. And let's go to another member of the audience right over there.
Hi, my name is Marilena Perez, and I'm a daughter of a Dominican mother. And for us, the experience has been that, my mom came to this country, and she wanted to have us here. And so when she did, she was like, "Oh, for high school, we're going to go back to the Dominican Republic." And it was like, yeah, that sounds so great. Then we started just immersing ourselves in the whole culture. And it was like, we're not going to the Dominican Republic. I don't know. And it was that type of thing. And then my mom was like, "Oh, after you graduate from college, I'm moving back there and retiring." And it's like, now I'm on my master's degree. And she's like, "I'm going to retire once, you get more money and you're able to support me." And it's like this expectation that I'm going to just be paying for her pension or whatever in Dominican Republic. And I'm like, I'm going to be a social worker, and that's not going to happen. You know, I barely support myself. So it's like this expectation as, like, especially, like, the firstborn child of, like, an immigrant parent to basically just, like, be this, like, carrying on the American dream and kind of just, like, forging the path for everyone else in the family. And there's a lot of pressure and expectations.
You know, the financial experts say the best way to afford retirement is to move out of New York to a place where housing is cheaper. So maybe for some that's going to be the Dominican Republic, if their roots were there. Thank you very much, and we'll go right on to another speaker from the audience.
Hello. I am an Ethiopian immigrant, and I have been here many, many years. I just want to make some comments. Number one, I'd like to thank the university for giving us this opportunity to gather today. Also, Brian Lyer, I heard from him yesterday about this show, and I decided to come. So I thank him very much for doing such a wonderful show-and-tell kind of program. The comment I have is, number one, it is the political aspect that makes people, a lot of people, migrate and stay in their in the adapted country. That needs to be acknowledged. Political means life or death. This is very serious in the developing nations. For example, 20-something years ago, Ethiopia was communist. To go back after you educate from the United States is to die, because they never wanted any educated people from the United States to go back to those countries. So this is very key important issues.
Thank you for speaking up about that. And Rob Smith, your book also touches on this very important idea that changes in Mexican national politics affect politics there and here. And I presume the changes here now affect politics both here and there.
Yeah, it's sort of a cliche that we, you know, we live in a global village. But, you know, I can, if I go back to the Mixteca region of Mexico, a third of the local mayoral races have been affected by migrants returning or sending money back. You know, I can go to other parts of Mexico, or, you know, look at the president of the Dominican Republic has a green card, went to the New York City public schools, Leonel Fernandez.
Gary Pierre, what about in the case of Haiti? Does the Haitian diaspora affect things politically in Haiti, tough as they are?
Well, certainly. I mean, the best example of that was Aristide. He built his candidacy largely by catering to Haitian Americans. And in many ways, he was more popular in Miami and New York than he was in Port-au-Prince in his last days, because people still saw him here as a prophet, whereas in Haiti, his image had been tarnished tremendously. And now, as you know, or you may not know, there's going to be presidential elections in November, and all the candidates are making a tour in New York, in Miami, in Boston, seeking the money and the vote and the support of our newspaper or the radio station and average citizen. It has played a tremendous role in the politics of Haiti, but they've refused to allow Haitians living here to vote. They want it both ways.
Can Mexicans living here vote in regional elections?
No. I mean, what this is interesting, and it's an old issue too. Mexicans get dual nationality, which means they can hold two passports, but not dual citizenship, which means they can't vote. If you go back 100 years ago, Italians living in the United States wanted dual citizenship, and Italy was afraid to do it for fear that they would be seen as a fifth column. But what happens, my co-panelist is quite correct, sending, you know, states like Haiti, Mexico, and others, they want the dollars to come back, and they want people to come back as tourists, and they want them to come back as political forces when they're on the same side, right? So Aristide wanted the diaspora to be mobilized when he was trying to get rid of the Duvaliers and trying to get rid of the military junta, but he demobilized them quite severely after he was president, because he no longer wanted their influence, because now he was the one who was trying to run things. So you could make a cynical political calculus about these diasporic relationships.
We're going to move on to our discussion of hybrid arts and culture in New York City in just a minute. But Gary Pierre, I know you wanted to say something about the politics of being Haitian-American as opposed to African-American?
Well, not quite. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of great things to be said about being an immigrant here, and we all, I mean, the audience is a testament of it. But I think the point that I wanted to make oftentimes in our discussions about immigrants, we really skirt the issue of immigrant stereotypes of African-Americans and the relationship there and the condescension. I think a lot of immigrants, even to this day, we tend to come from middle-class background. Whether we work as security guards or bus drivers, we tend to be middle-class and educated, and we have this really condescending attitude towards African-American. I think immigrants need to be educated about the politics of America and the role that African-Americans play there.
All right. We're going to change direction in a minute and talk about New York as a city of hybrid arts and culture. Please thank our first panelists, Rob Smith, Chung-Hwa Han, Gary Pierre-Pierre, and Cindy Rodriguez. Artists are DJ Reka and Dave Sherman. The track is Bangal. The genre is called Bhangra. It's Indo-British pop music that's starting to get big in New York. And there is probably no bigger name on the New York Bhangra scene than my next guest, Reka Malhotra, a.k.a. DJ Reka, founder of the popular Basement Bhangra Nights at SOBs in Lower Manhattan. Born in London, raised in Queens and Westbury, DJ Reka went to Queens College, got into radio and DJing there, and founded Basement Bhangra in 1999. She says she is committed to spreading British Asian music in New York. She also sees her involvement with music as inseparable from community activism. And with that, we continue our Feet in Two Worlds special from the New School with a look at the hybrid arts and culture being created by immigrants and their children. I said DJ Reka is our next guest. She's really one of our next guests. And also with us, Germán Pérez, a Dominican-American visual artist, primarily a painter who lives in Manhattan, and Arun Venugopal, a reporter for India Abroad, who also reported this story for our Feet in Two Worlds documentary, in which the gay, Indian, immigrant, and comedy worlds all collide.
You know, there are a billion people in India, and if you believe the official statistics, four gays. Which means I represent 25% of India's gay population. And I live in Chelsea, in Manhattan.
It's a Friday night in New York, and a funny thing is happening. Stand-up comedian Vidura Kapoor is giving a crowd of South Asians, Indian and Pakistani 20 and 30-somethings, a tutorial on being Indian and gay. They seem to get most of his jokes. This is the Queer Eye generation, after all. But some of his material just doesn't connect.
Hello!
Some audience members admit this is the first time they've actually encountered a Desi, or South Asian, who is openly gay.
I guess it's not natural or normal for many Indian communities to have a gay comedian come up and do a stand-up.
For many people with South Asian roots, gayness is a Western concept. Most gay and lesbian Desis are closeted to their family and community. This is especially true in India and Pakistan, where homosexuality is illegal. But in New York, it's a different story. Here, activists, visual artists, and performers like Vidur have begun challenging the stigma that comes with being South Asian and gay.
Reporter Arun Venugopal from India Abroad and a contributor to our Feet in Two Worlds documentary, which will air a number of times on the station beginning on May 20th. Arun is one of our panelists now. And so what was revealed in that segment for you?
Well, I suppose the story kind of, or at least the subject matter of this scene, kind of happened to surface for me at the same time that I was
discovering that there was actually this entire South Asian comedy scene emerging in the U.S., especially in New York. So it just happened to be, I guess, a nice coincidence that there was one of them who was South Asian, gay, and a stand-up comedian, Vidur. And I guess it was quite, even though I'd been to some of these parties that you heard at the end of the segment, it's still, even for somebody like me, it was quite an introduction, I guess, to this world that you can very well be cut off from if you don't know about it. As you heard that guy who I briefly spoke to, when I spoke a little more to him off the air, he was stunned that this kind of a, you know, scene existed, or even that there were gay South Asian people. And it was sort of an unabashed kind of a, I guess, curiosity he had. And I guess it made me realize that there is an entire, probably the majority of our community has no clue that this kind of thing exists, this party scene, or even that there is a fairly sophisticated network, social and otherwise, of gay South Asians in this country.
Is it another indication of the two-way street that transnationalism is? Because Indian immigrants would come to the United States where homosexuality is more accepted, and this ultimately might bounce back toward India, where I understand it's not even legal, no less talked about very much.
Right. I mean, there are consistent challenges to that going all the way up to the Supreme Court in India, and it's been, I guess, struck down even fairly recently. But I think culturally, in cities like Bombay or Mumbai, as it's known now, there does appear to be a stronger and stronger gay scene that seems to coexist, I guess, with them, or seems to be doing okay and isn't really struck down that hard. But yeah, definitely there is sort of this, I guess, transnational quality that happens. Cities like New York and, to a lesser extent, I suppose, the Bay Area and smaller cities in the U.S. and definitely Toronto and Canada, London, they have very strong gay South Asian scenes, which do definitely impact back in places like Karachi and Bombay.
Herman, hi.
How you doing?
We haven't gotten to hear your voice yet. You've said that New York is the only place in the hemisphere that tolerates creative artists who want to be themselves. Everywhere else, they look at you like you're weird. Why do you think New York is so artist-friendly?
First of all, I consider myself not as an economical immigrant like the most of the people that immigrate to this country.
From the Dominican Republic.
I'm mostly like a cultural immigrant. Because when I came to this country, I came with a visa, and I would say in a privilege in my position as an immigrant in this country, because I came as an artist already. And I didn't pass all the struggle that people pass.
What does that mean, a cultural immigrant?
What's mean is, when I came to this country, I already was well known in my country as a painter. But I understand, as an island, that was a very difficult platform to launch my career as a painter. On the other hand, New York gave me the opportunity to travel everywhere. And at some point, people pass through here, people from Japan or from Europe or from South America. It's more like strategic for me to live in New York, that like an economical immigrant, that the most of the people from my country.
A classic immigrant's driver who comes to New York from Iowa or Kansas or the Dominican Republic to make it.
I believe immigration have different phases. And United States is the make-believe country around the world. They promote this country in all the movies and the food. And people come here with a lot of expectation. When they find out that they are, some of them is, they are not real. It's just like an oasis. But when you're here, you have to deal with reality. You can't come back, as somebody say, you know.
Right. The woman from Nigeria who was speaking before, discovering, as many before her have, that the streets are not actually paved with gold. But you're here how long now?
25 years.
So something worked for you here.
Well, I marry a Mexican, and then you have three legs.
Feet in three worlds, and you have to grow another leg.
At some point, you have to say, we're not coming back to Mexico. We're not coming back to the Dominican Republic. What are we going to do? And that our kids born here, we have to stay here. There's no choice.
So, DJ Rekha, you'd like somebody with three legs coming to one of your dance parties, wouldn't you?
Only if they pay 1.5 times if they
want. For the uninitiated, what is Bhangra music? What are the Basement Bhangra events? And are they meant to be South Asian, Indian, Pakistani, mostly in tone, or completely world music eclectic? What are you trying to do?
Okay, Bhangra is a music that comes out of a dance originally from a region of called Punjab, which is divided by India and Pakistan, the countries that were formed in 1947. And the music has sort of, it was transported to the UK post-World War II with UK immigration from both Indian and Pakistani communities. And most of Bhangra music is actually produced in the UK. And it's sort of melded with current dance style, so it's produced the same way hip-hop and dance music is produced. And music is for everyone. Basement Bhangra is a monthly party I do at SOB's in downtown New York, Sounds of Brazil, a Brazilian nightclub, of course. I've been doing it for 8 years now, and my goal with that party was to have anyone who wants to dance come to the party. I think one of the strategies for marketing that party were to not make it exclusively to South Asians, but there is enough of a South Asian presence there that it does feel like a safe South Asian space.
How old were you when you came from London to this country?
4, going on 5.
Okay, so you went from the British Isles to the island of Long.
To the island of Long, yes.
And now the island of Manhattan. And I don't know, have you spent time in London as an adult? Or
yes, I have.
Elsewhere?
I go to London frequently.
Do you have a sense, as Herman, that New York is really the only place to be an artist because people don't look at you weird? Or maybe London's pretty good, too.
London's okay. I think the political climate in London for people of color is very challenging.
More than the United States?
Yes. I mean, in different ways. I think it's completely different. On the one hand, there's a lot more state-sponsored funding for artists in the UK. But on the other hand, I think, the political climate for people of color in the UK is very difficult. I think that's one of the reasons why my parents actually did not like living in England. They were there for 6 years and found it much more friendly here in terms of opportunity and various things. It's hard to say. New York has an energy and a vibe to it that is inexplicable, and it's amazing. And there are other cities in the world that have that kind of energy. And people often compare Bombay to that, having that sort of energy, this sense of urgency, and everyone's got their hustle going on. Everyone's got something to do, someplace to be. And whether it's art or finance or whatever arena you're in, this is, some sort of at least cultural epicenter for some people.
And Aruna is a reporter for the publication India Abroad. Do you see those comparisons in your experience or maybe in your colleagues' experience between being South Asian in the UK and being South Asian in New York?
Well, I think that the South Asian cultures or, South Asian itself is sort of a fairly kind of recent construct. It's not something that, at least when I grew up in Texas, nobody ever referred to us, we didn't refer to ourselves as South Asian. It's sort of something that has been embraced in the West, at least in the U.S. in more recent years.
We did a whole show on that, actually, a couple of weeks ago. But basically, it's people from the countries that now comprise the Indian subcontinent, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, more or less. Yes?
Yes. Yeah, right. I mean, I guess the dominant populations would be from those three, and then you have smaller populations from Sri Lanka and
right.
Nepal and such.
Could it be that it's easier to be a South Asian immigrant in New York because there are fewer of you relative to the rest of the population, whereas it's more of a dominant minority group in London, which the white Britishers find more threatening, therefore?
I suppose, not having lived in London, I would have to sort of make a stretch there, but I do think that basically the fact that for many Indians, at least, who came to the U.S., the fact that they were many of them were white-collar professionals who came in the 60s, starting in the 60s, and to a lesser extent, of course, in the 90s onwards, but there isn't the same sort of blue-collar consciousness in this country, with Indians at least. I think that it's greater in the UK in that way, and that perhaps would create a sort of different dynamic in terms of the solidarity.
Rekha, do you want to add to that?
One thing I'd like to add in terms of the definition of South Asian, we'd also, I think it's necessary to include Caribbean, Indo-Caribbean immigrants, because it's about tracing your origins back too. And the more colloquial expression for South Asians, which is Desi, which might have come up, which is from a Sanskrit language from the word Desh, which means of my country. I think that, you know, what's the question again? What are we talking about?
Well, we were just talking about the relative ease that you first brought up of being an Indian in New York as opposed to London.
You know, in some ways it's very comforting to be an Indian in London because there's so many of them there. But I do think that there's plenty of South Asians in New York as well. I remember when I was 15 and I stopped in London on the way to India, and I saw in the airport there were people, this auntie was cleaning, vacuuming in a sari, an airport uniform, and I went to the subway there and I walked around and there were a lot of South Asians in sort of like service professions, and I thought, wow, this is so crazy, this is nuts, I can't believe there are that many Desis. And we look around New York City today and we see the same thing. I think the South Asian community is extremely diverse, and it's actually very class stratified. And so the sort of scale is doctor or cab driver, which one excludes women in that sort of thinking, and two, it does not take to account that there are many, many different stories. There are many immigrants that are second waivers that came in the 90s as a result of being sponsored by their siblings who had professional jobs, who have a really hard time making it here. And some of those, one of those stories is referenced in a book by Mitra Kala, who was on your show, Suburban Sahibs. And there are a lot of different stories, I think, within our community.
And Herman, we mentioned earlier in the program how Dominicans, for a long time now really, are the number one immigrant group to New York in terms of population. Does it make it easier as the population swells? Does it make it in any way harder?
The Dominican population is a very unique immigration. If the difference between, let's say, the Cuban and the Dominican immigration is the Cuban, they can go back to Cuba. For that reason, they establish in the United States, they create goods, they think it in the future. On the other hand, Dominicans, they spend half of the year thinking when they're going to go back to Dominican Republic. And in the end, that's it's a big problem, because a community that has been here for 40 years and is not integrated, doesn't have representation in the Senate, or some of them, they don't even have money in the bank. They use cash. That way, Cuban community, they have a big lobby in Washington. They have influence in politics about Cuban politics, about even internal politics in the United States. And for my community, it's very sad, because it's a big population with no influence, and not influence in all the levels, in schools and medicine and everything.
What would it take to develop that influence, in your opinion?
Marry somebody else from someplace else.
Marry a Cuban, marry an Italian, marry
that
a
That happened
Jew.
To me. Yeah, I can't think in bringing all my family to the Dominican Republic, because they don't belong there. Even I try to give them some of my heritage, but they still, my kids, they feel the flag from the United States is their flag, no Dominican flag.
We'll continue after a break in a minute, and we invite members of our audience to speak up again. In what ways has the everyday cultural life of the city's neighborhoods and ethnic communities become multi-ethnic? Talk about cultural hybrid New York. It's our Feet in Two Worlds community event from the New School on West 13th Street in Manhattan. I'm Brian Lehrer with a special edition of our program. Right now, the hybrid cultural lives of the global city with DJ Reka, host of SOB's monthly basement Bhangra dance parties and creator of the Feet in Two Worlds soundtrack, both for the documentary Feet in Two Worlds that will debut on the station next week, and she provided all the music that we've been playing during our breaks here today, all this great stuff. Also, Herman Perez, Dominican-American visual artist, and Arun Venugopal, a reporter for the publication India Abroad, who also contributed a piece to the Feet in Two Worlds documentary. Again, we thank everybody in our audience for coming out here to New School University today. And so we pose the questions to some of you here who come originally from so many places around the world. How has the multicultural reality of life in New York City changed our nightlife, our art, our literature, and our music? Your appreciation of any of those things? How has U.S. culture continued to shape and influence these things from the U.S. side, perhaps in a new mix, a new cultural hybrid that maybe even gets reflected back in the home country? Let's go to a member of our audience. Ma'am, thank you for speaking up.
My name is Mira Nair, and I have a question for German Perez. I'd like to ask you, what, as an artist, what does it mean to you to live here? I mean, in New York. I mean, you developed as an artist, say, in the Dominican Republic, and I don't know if you're still inspired and influenced by the Dominican Republic. And how has that changed because you live here, or has it changed at all?
Basically, you know, when you immigrate, you bring all your dreams, all your background with you. And that's what you use to create. All the creator use memories that you have from your childhood. And if you're talking from your heart, that's what you're going to use. That means you can break the links with you, with the homeland. And what I've been trying to do in the years is get the inspiration in the immigration part of my country. Trying to relate my painting to those feelings that people have, and even trying to translate that to a bigger picture when you as an immigrant can see my painting and see yourself there too. Trying to look in those ideas that can be similar to anybody from any place, looking those ideas through my reality and try to reflect it to anybody else.
DJ Reka, is there an equivalent in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course we bring everything. Well, I like to say people bring their whole histories to the dance floor in terms of what they know, what they like to dance to, what they respond to. And, you know, first and foremost, you're a human being, and a lot of all your experiences inform your art, and location is one of them. And it's your own mindset. It's your, what you take in. I mean, we can sit in New York, but I can find out everything that's going on anywhere in the world. And I think that all shapes of our experiences. And it's hard to know if you stay in one place how your art would change or not. But it's very exciting to be in a city that just constantly stimulates you and makes you think about different things, and that you can also be exposed to so many different things on any given day.
Let's go to another member of the audience. Ma'am.
Yeah, hi. My name is Melinda Holm. It's also for Mr. Perez. When you came here, did you have help from your community to establish your career and to get your art exposed and to the public? And do you have any kind? Are you primarily in Hispanic galleries, or are you in galleries that kind of cross over? And also, do you have the same opportunity as American artists to be artists in residences at universities?
In order for your question, could you repeat it again? It's three questions at the same time. I want to try to.
Okay, the first one was, when you first came here to get established, did you have support from the Dominican community?
Yeah,
or?
But let me answer that one first. The Dominican community is basically, at that point, 25 years ago, when I emigrated to this country, was workers. That means they don't have the sense to admire art. You know, and some kind of art, you have to have some kind of education to decode, and mostly the painting. That's why if you don't have people educated, they can't understand what Picasso was doing about it. They see like a kid's drawing, but it's something behind. When you have education, that make my community, the Dominican community, have that lack of education. I can bring my work. And I did one of the cows. You see the cows from New York? I did the cow for the immigrants. And my sponsor was this Hispanic newspaper. And they wanted to put my cow was inside a boat. And my sponsor, El Diario La Prensa, wanted to put the cow inside a community. I tell, don't do that. Because if you do that, Dominicans come here in boats. And they don't know that there is 500 cows in the cities because they don't go around. They're going to think that you put that cow there, meaning to them that they are cows. And they listened to me, and they put it in Battery Park. Then the Dominican community was so proud that a Dominican was in Battery Park with one of the cows.
But is it also, Herman, somewhat of an elitist attitude to say that ordinary Dominicans, because they're not educated, don't understand art? Maybe that's one kind of art, but doesn't art in almost every culture in the world also flow spontaneously from people's cultural conditions, whatever they are?
Yeah, that's true. It's come from the people, but most of the time it's not for the consumer of the people. If you have Mesopotamia and the Metropolitan Museum, if you count how many Dominicans went to see that show, maybe it's, 200 people, because they don't have that as something important. On the other hand, is Sammy Sosa is playing with the Mets, you're going to have, half of the Dominican population.
Reka?
It's a matter of taste,
well,
I would say.
That's also, we're talking about issues of high and lowbrow art, but also about who's it for and why is it made and who's it consumable. I mean, my personal experience as an artist was I actually got recognized from the New York music press way before the Indian press ever acknowledged me, though they did do their job eventually.
Thank you.
And because I situated, because my event and what I did was situated, I think, in New York as part of a downtown music scene. And I think that, after all that stuff happened and there was an acknowledgement, then people started actually saying, well, let's check this out, or now we're recognizing you. And it's really interesting to see where, as artists, people get their, quote, legitimacy from and the way communities respond to it. They like to harp on certain things which are very obvious things, like, people become symbols for communities, like, Sammy Sosa, the baseball player, and it was amazing to see that summer all over people's cars and counting his home runs, and I think is amazing, as well as one of the pieces of music that I included in the piece was an instrumental of a reggaeton track, which is music that's really very much New York, even though it comes out of,
Reggaeton, reggae and Spanish, so cross of Jamaican and Spanish cultures primarily, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's
filtered
through
New York.
Absolutely.
Coming from Puerto Rico, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Puerto Rico is the base.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show community event called Feet in Two Worlds from the New School University, the segment of the special, The Hybrid Cultural Lives of the Global City. And let's go to another member of the audience. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Bix, and I want to make two quick points apart from the point on my T-shirt, which reads Citizen of the World. I wanted to say that I think one of the joys and pains of being immigrant, which hasn't come through here so much, is not that you have just two identities, but that you have multiple identities. Being over here from India originally, I now identify as South Asian, as Desi, as, an artist of color, all these things, which, I think is part of the immigrant experience and something that you have to own up to at some point or the other, whether you like it or not in some cases. And the other quick point I wanted to make is that, as immigrants, we are a very divided lot within our own communities, but across immigrant communities. And it's a huge struggle. And Mr. Herman said one of the things is you can do to overcome that is through marriage. But I think one of the things that we haven't talked about today, which is also a great way to be multicultural or to enjoy other cultures and other identities, is through food.
So you wear a Citizen of the World T-shirt, orange with black lettering, and you go out. And how does it make you feel when people see that T-shirt and then respond, "So where are you from?"
Well, I was at the post office today, and everybody kept commenting on my T-shirt. And I have to say, the line moved a lot quicker, which was great. But it's very hard to answer that question, whether I wear this T-shirt or not, you know, because people always... Actually, people don't ask me where am I from. They say, "So you're from Guyana. You're from Trinidad. You're from wherever."
They look at you and they guess.
Yes, they make assumptions.
Let's go to another member of the audience right over there. Hi.
Yes, I agree with integral part of culture is food, and I get that in Queens. I'm from Uruguay. I've been here for 20 years, and I can just go to Queens and have the same food that I have in Uruguay. And also music in the last couple of years. There's a monthly party of South Americans, which they play music which I've never heard before because I've always heard here salsa and merengue. But there's all this new pop music from South America and also tango that I've been able to enjoy here in New York also.
So another kind of hybridization, salsa merengue, right? Is that what you said?
There's a new pop music from South America, but like rock in Spanish or...
Reka, you want to say something?
Rock in Espanol, yeah. There's a lot of alternative South Asian... South Asian, South American, what's the difference? There's a lot of new music from Mexico as well as South America. It's called Rock in Espanol, and... pretty big SOBs has done a bunch of shows with some of those artists.
So, Arun, why do you think New York continues to be this vibrant, multicultural, artistic hub?
Well, I think that at least for people who are creatively inclined, and say if you're of either an immigrant or a child of one, it's not just the numbers, but it's the fact that you can both tap into what you might consider a fairly authentic experience, which is drawn, I guess, more immediately from your homeland. But you can also be with people who might be a little more reflective on the experience, with people who, I guess, are in that sense of in two worlds, that they can both experience it in a more immediate sense and at the same time kind of reflect on it in a broader way.
Let's go to another member of the audience over here, sir.
My name is Ayo. I'm from Nigeria. Yeah, I was just thinking maybe there should be less emphasis on transnationalism and more on transculturalism.
What's the difference?
Difference being the notion of identity now is related to what you would call microcultures, like the profile of people now is not so much... influenced by the stereotype from the countries they come from. So it's more related to all these subcultures that penetrates into their country and into their mind. So in a way, you have a lot of people, when they come here, they start to live, their identity is far off from what you expect them to do. And I have a friend from England who opened a Korean restaurant, and I have another one from Nigeria who opened an Ethiopian restaurant. Well, the Korean restaurant is actually on Mercer. It's called Wan Wan Cafe, okay? And it's run by my friend who is Jewish from England.
And I know an Ecuadorian who runs a pizza place.
Yeah, and I even had a store which was selling world music, and my specialty was more like... what do you want to call it? Arabic music, even though I'm from Nigeria.
Transnational, transculture?
I think that with that is sort of accurate, at least in New York, with this term Desi, as it applies to South Asians. It's sort of this very kind of progressive, idealistic sort of removal of national boundaries kind of as they were violently thrown up, I guess, at independence of India and Pakistan. And it's really taken root very, very effectively in New York and beyond. So I think that the term really does kind of resonate when you look at least within this context.
So we're going to run out of time here in a minute. Herman, if we do this show 10 years from now, how different is the conversation going to be?
I believe like Latin America is a new, the young culture in the planet. Is we just been discovered very recently, and we are still under-discovered as countries. You know, the most of the countries in the planet, they have huge history and a lot of baggage in the cultural stuff. But Latin America is something new that people don't discover yet. And as that, I believe that's the future.
And that is the last word. The Brian Lehrer Show is produced by Nuala McGovern, Jim Colgan, and Priya George. Help from Daniel McDermott and Lizzie McGlynn on this Feed Into World special at the New School University. Special thanks for this special to Andrew White, Mia Lipset, Brian Case, John Rudolph. Engineering by Irene Trudell, Jennifer Munson, and Elena Nacanther. The town hall at the New School was made possible thanks to the generous support of the New York Community Trust, the David and Catherine Moore Family Foundation, and the New York Council for the Humanities. Remember that the documentary Feet in Two Worlds will air four times on WNYC beginning on May the 20th. Check our website at WNYC.org to find out exactly when, or just tune in because we'll give you a lot of more specific information. This has been our Feet in Two Worlds community event. We thank the Milano Graduate School. We thank our final guest, Herman Perez, DJ Rekha, and Arun Venugopal. Please thank all our guests and thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.